friends, and welcome to Conversations with Consequences, where we are changing the culture one conversation at a time. We are the radio show and podcast of the Catholic Association. We address the issues that interest you, puzzle you, and flame you in the hope that we can bring some clarity, even to the darkest corners. You can listen to Conversations with Consequences on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network, Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. Eastern Time, or you can catch the encore at 5 p.m. We are also on SiriusXM Channel 130. Of course, our radio show is always a podcast. Go to thecatholicassociation.org/podcasts or directly to wherever you listen to your podcasts. I'm your hostess, Dr. Gracie Christie, and from all of us here at the Catholic Association, from all of us at Conversations with Consequences, we wish you a very, very happy Thanksgiving, and we'd like to say that we're very thankful for you. Our listeners. I know we talk a lot about dignity of life issues, especially vulnerable preborn human life, pregnant moms and their babies. We talk a lot about that on the show on Conversations with Consequences, but it really is an issue that galvanizes us, and it should galvanize every Catholic, because in a world where the most vulnerable are discarded and are made part of that terrible throwaway culture that Pope Francis talks about, in that world, how can anything go right? What can we expect from a culture that's sacrifices their own babies on the altar of sexual liberation? Yes, we do spend a lot of time talking about these things. We do so because we are really moved for the plight of babies, the plight of their mothers, the plight of their fathers and their extended families, and the plight of our whole culture, which suffers terribly from the blight of abortion and has since 1973, when it became legal because of Roe v. Wade. We've asked Archbishop Joseph Naumann of Kansas City, who serves as the pro-life chair for the USCCB. But first, I'm happy to have my TCA colleague Lee Sneed with me as we chat with Dr. John Brachalski. He is OBGYN, a pro-life OBGYN at Divine Mercy Care and Tepeyac Clinic in the DC area. He serves so many women and babies as an OBGYN, also travels across the nation sharing a pro-life message and helping women choose life. Lee, thank you so much for joining us today. As co-hostess, before we bring Dr. Brachalski on, I'd love to chat with you about one of the many things we have in common. We're both adoptive mothers.
And our experiences are different, but I'll talk about mine first. I have three sons, all adopted domestically as newborns. I have a 16, almost 17-year-old, and then after he was born, we adopted twins. I do hate to share my story as much as I love to preach the joys of adoption to anyone interested, because it wasn't very long. It didn't take us very long to get matched with a birth mother. In fact, it was about 6 weeks between our first meeting with the adoption agency, getting chosen by birth parents, and then having my newborn baby in my arms. About 6 weeks from the first meeting, and then it was about 1 to 2 weeks before the due date that we found out we'd been chosen. And so
that's amazing, Lee.
It was amazing. And then when we actually worked with another Catholic medical hero, Dr. Hilgers, for a while, and then we spent some time abroad and we just still weren't getting pregnant. And I thought, we took a break and I thought, maybe we should get going again. And my husband said, it's actually great not having to worry about this month to month. Let's just adopt again. We love our son. Let's just adopt again. And we did. And 48 hours after we had turned in all of our background work and paperwork, et cetera, I was in the delivery room seeing my twins being born. Yeah.
48 hours.
So it happened fast both times.
Wait, so Lee, you saw your children being born?
The twins, not the first.
That's spectacular.
He was about 12 years old, I think, maybe. 12 hours.
12 hours.
Yeah.
I have a sadness in my life. I love my adopted daughter and I give thanks for her day and night. And I feel sad that I didn't know her for the first months of her life, that I wasn't at her birth, that I wasn't in the beginning when I first fell in love with her. I thought about this all the time and it hurt me that I wasn't there for her. Now, as I see her developing so well and so beautifully, I don't think about that so much, but definitely it was a sadness for me. So I'm really happy that you had them right from the beginning. That's very, very nice.
It's always relative too, because you had that experience to compare with your biological children. For me, I didn't have biological children, so I wish that I had sort of known them in the womb, and been able to be with them from the first moment. And I mean, although we like to say they were in our hearts, there's something very physical about a mother-child relationship, especially in those early days. And for me, I was lucky that I worked with a wonderful lactation consultant, and a lot of women don't know it's possible, but I was able to induce lactation.
Were you really?
Yes.
And, so and, the, and nice they were and they were newborns.
Cooperate with you finally.
And they were newborns because I know sometimes people try to do that with older babies, mm-hmm. and that's very difficult. And it's I think it's a, maybe a little hard on the baby who's been drinking from a bottle.
Too.
That
beautiful.
Process, the process of falling in love with your children and having your children fall in love with you. For you, maybe it was a little different because they were newborns. But many moms mm-hmm. by adoption and fathers by adoption, we do this when the children are a little older, and it's really a lovely process. It's very different from giving birth and receiving the children as newborns or right from our own bodies. But it's so pretty. And I was actually talking to my adopted daughter is now 14. And on the way to school a couple days ago, I was telling her that adoption is the way that God relates to each of us by that's how he chose to relate to us. He adopts right. us and he makes us his children through adoption. I was telling her, you see, it is such a lovely, elevated, dignified, noble thing that God chose it. God chose that as the vehicle by which he would communicate with us. He would make us his own. And so I'm sure I've said this to her before, but I think it really registered this time. I told her, you know, you're a very special girl because you have your birth parents somewhere, and I'm sure they love you and think of you all the time, and we pray for them and they pray for you, I'm very sure. And now you have this relationship with us that is very, that it mirrors the relationship of God mm-hmm. with his children, with his human children.
Yeah, and I think that's a story that needs to be retold to our children over and over again because, you know, they mature so fast and they're little minds and their souls change all the time, and they relate to that information in a different way. So yeah, I think it only gets better.
Now, the reason, Lee, that you and I wanted to talk on the show about this particular topic about adoption is because October is Respect Life Month, mm-hmm. and adoption is the loving option. As my daughter was holding a sign on the side of the street a couple of days ago.
My son did that too.
Yeah,
he said, "Yep, he said adoption is a loving option. It's the same sign." Yep, all his mm-hmm. friends actually handed him that sign when they all went down to the pro-life march.
Yeah, and it's such yeah. a beautiful sign because truly, once you have an adopted child, once you know an adopted child, you realize there are no extra children. There are no unwanted children. There are no children that ought to be destroyed. You know, every single child is this perfect gift from God. If mm-hmm. only we can find the grace to receive them.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So yeah. let's hope that October Respect Life Month, there's lots of demonstrations, lots of thoughtful dialogue about what's better. You know, I had this talk with somebody. I invited a woman I know. I don't know her very well, but I invited her to go to the march with us. This was a Chain for Life a few days ago that's held all across the United States. She said to me, you know, I would never personally, this is a very common refrain, I would never personally have an abortion, but, you know, I worry about all those children that are born and then abused. And maybe it would have been better for them. And I said to her, she didn't know I had an adopted child at the time. So I said to her, well, you know, there's other options. There's more options than death or abuse. I said, there's adoption, for instance, like, you know, my daughter. She goes, oh, I didn't know. She said, you know, you're right. I'm going to come to that march.
So, that's wonderful. Good evangelizing.
That is good event. Yeah, I think we need to change hearts one at a time and try to create that culture one person at a time. Create the culture where abortion is unthinkable.
And that adoption is always celebrated because I've had people even say, when I say like, oh, well, my children are adopted, they'll say, oh, I'm sorry.
Oh.
I'm like, what? What? Are you kidding? It's the best thing that has ever, ever happened to me. And, you know, I like to think it's pretty good for them, too. But, you know,
I'm sure it's wonderful for them.
Yeah. So anyway, it's just so I think that people have some ideas that are stuck in the past with maybe some bad practices. They've heard a few horror stories and it tarnishes the whole beautiful practice.
Well, you know, there's humans involved in it. So there's going to mm-hmm. be mistakes and things are going to go wrong sometimes. But for sure, it's the loving option. Lee, it's really wonderful talking to another adoptive mom about these beautiful concepts. I hope that our listeners are moved by our experiences.
Me too. I love talking about adoption. I could talk about it all day long.
You know, now let's bring on the phone Dr. John Bruchelski. He is a physician and OBGYN extraordinaire. He heads up the Tepeyac Clinic in Northern Virginia, and he is also the man behind Divine Mercy Care. He's an OBGYN who has devoted his life after his conversion to making the world of OBGYN a world that is completely welcoming to the child. Sees the child as a patient, sees the mother and the child as a unit. In fact, sees the mother and the father and the child as a unit, sees the whole family. So let's talk to Dr. John Bruchelski.
Dr. Bruchelski, we were so happy to see that the University of Notre Dame awarded you with the Evangelium Vitae Award for next year. And my husband, Carter Sneed, wrote in the press release, I have to say too, I have to interrupt myself to say that I can't tell you the number of text messages and phone calls I've gotten from people in this community who have been patients of yours, who have had babies delivered by you, who are asking me to book them seats, and I have to remind them that I don't work there, but I will try to get them do the best I can. I'll direct them to the
You're dealing with anyway. A superstar, Lee.
Yes, I know.
Oh, please.
Yeah, I know. So anyway, people are dying to get to you. So my husband wrote in the press release, Dr. Buchalski is a shining example of the church's untiring commitment to directly serving mothers, children, and families. Your work is such a vital component to our pro-life commitment as Catholics, and your work, Doctor, has been spurred on by your own conversion. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Lee, thank you so much for the kindness. Sometimes I get a little awkward with being honored for not killing babies and trying to care for those who are weakest in our community. And with all the people that I've delivered, because I'm so old, it's all paid advertisement, as they would say. And so I'm really humbled and just overwhelmed. I'm a poster child for the Catholics. Growing up since the 1960s, all the goods and bads of what that means. I've lived through that, including drinking the Kool-Aid or buying the lie that women deserve abortion as health care. So I wanted to liberate women from their fertility to give them happiness and joy and peace. And I ended up practicing what I preached because, you know, my daddy, who was an incredible man who loved the Lord, loved Our Lady, loved the church, loved our country, he also taught in a high school these very principles. Well, because I believed in a woman's right to choose, I went ahead and learned how to terminate and abort all size babies, provide all sorts of contraception. And it was only because of my mom and dad, I think, who dedicated me to Our Lady, but also so many people out there, so many of the incredible pro-life movement, those people who are just silent, they prayed for conversion. And thanks be to God, through circumstances that I cannot even imagine, but through patients and through other doctors and through other people and through students, I came to my senses where I had an experience with the Mother of God a few times in my life. And all of a sudden, the truth became alive. And it was always about consequences. I love the program, Conversations with Consequences, right? Well, it's now about the conversation of conversion, but it's not with words. It's with your heart and it's with your actions. I see what your program does, Dr. Christie. It moves me to the point that these people put their heart, the love of Christ, into what they're doing.
Thank you, Doctor.
That's the key. Oh, no, I'm serious. So I'm trying to prep. I was looking just at who you had on and whether it's the heartbeat bill, which is politics, or whether it's servicing, which is, you know, social, you know, psychiatry. You talk about people who have heart in their work. Because once again, words have a very difficult meaning these days. My God, mercy. It means different things to different people. Women. I can't even use the word women anymore.
Right.
Recently at the hospital, I got hit on, oh no, these are birthing people, John. And so the whole world's changing. But what does transpire is the love of Jesus. And the best example of that was the Mother of God.
John, that moment of conversion that you had, it must have turned your entire life upside down. But I also imagine that you brought so much beautiful energy to it, like a real enthusiasm. Is that true or am I imagining that wrong?
I am sure that you are correct. It's very hard to capture in my heart and in my words what happened. But I can tell you, I felt loved. I felt loved for the first time in my life. Mm-hmm. I felt the love of my parents. I felt the love of all these family members who prayed for me, knowing that I was kind of off the rails, so to speak, and I was destroying life and I was hurting women. And yet they just prayed for me. And when you meet Jesus and Mary heart to heart, as St. Francis de Sales would say, or eye to eye, or your whole life changes. And you can never go back, meaning the holes, the pain that he suffered so that I could become whole again and come to know him. And once again, it's not the work I do. It's not the work you do, but it's the knowledge and the relationship with Jesus Christ. We talk about it here at the office all the time. Health is based on relationships that are sacrificial.
Mm-hmm.
The relationship between you and your family, the relationship between you and your physician or your healthcare provider, but also the most important, between you and Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since, Constantine and his mom kind of introduced this, so you know, thousands of years ago. The world has been pushing back, and it just seems as if we've gotten to a point now where words no longer matter, everything's become fossilized, and it's only going to be the love of Christ and the love of us left here on this earth doing his, building his kingdom come.
When you were describing this, the way that you experienced your conversion, it reminded me of the very real, of the reality that when people who are pro-life, whether we're Catholic or of other denominations, when we propose that there is a possibility of change, that you can come back from the other side, it's a proposal of mercy, of real love and mercy. And and when people, yes, when we experience it, when maybe some of us have been on the other side like you and have come back, and I wasn't always passionately pro-life, when you experience that wonderful welcome of saying, your past doesn't matter, we've all made mistakes, God's merciful, bounteous love is ready to wash all over you and just make you happy.
Yeah, no, it's so true. And that
with the sacrament of reconciliation, Catherine Jean Lopez is such a great social media presence to remind us all to run to the confessional every day, because, you know, even if you take a little step outside, you want to be back inside, and you know, it's possible for anybody.
I absolutely agree. That mercy and love breeds hope. And that hope, it becomes contagious and it fills your being. When I left the hill, I heard she said, go show yourself to the priest. And I can tell you that that confession coming off the hill after that experience that I had was the most wonderful, cleansing, peaceful moment that I can even. And so when I talk to folks, I would love them to come through our offices, through listening to your program, and go directly to confession, because there is a certain consequence. When you talk about conversations with consequences, I think about it, this conversation is for my consequence. It's helping me have a softer heart for others and to know that I am loved. And I want to share that with my female patients. You know, I'm a gynecologist, so it's my patients. And it's all about, especially if you're, you know, we're all in need. As Mother Teresa told me, oh no, Johnny, you see enough, you bring Calcutta to Fairfax, because even wealthy people need forgiveness and peace. No, so you're so right. And Catherine Lopez is just a tremendous voice out there in the wilderness for so many of us.
If you're just joining us, this is Conversations with Consequences. I'm your hostess, Dr. Gracie Christie. We have the great Dr. Bruchowski with us, and also my colleague Lee Sneed as co-hostess. But Dr. Bruchowski, you are famous everywhere for the way that you've been able to create an OBGYN practice with many other doctors that work with you and nurses, and in a way that welcomes the whole woman, all her fertility, all her great possibilities, all the wonderful possible futures of her life, and welcomes her whole family and her husband and the children. And how did you create such an amazing place?
She told me, the Blessed Mother told me what to do.
There you go.
I mean, I am not, I listen to you. I mean, I listen to people say this, and it had nothing to, I am humbled by it, but this is not something that I came up with. Johnny, be the best doctor you can be. See the least of your brothers and sisters, and follow the teachings of my son's church. Once again, people ask me for business plans, and it's almost a joke with me, because this was a matter of just simply following this mother to whatever door they opened. So I knew coming off that hill that I understood for the first time Humanae Vitae. I understood for the first time the catechism. I don't understand how it happened, but I can tell you that there was a deep connection of what it means to be human. And that also just transpired to my patients, meaning care for the whole person. Don't suppress fertility. Cooperate with it. Cooperate. Listen. It's slow medicine. This is not something that you can do with a quick test or a quick answer. This is about meeting people where they're at. This is about giving them the best advice you can, whether it's allopathic or naturopathic medicine. You present them options, and then you give them good science, and then you allow the Holy Spirit to enter through good prayer, body, soul, and spirit. You work on the forgiveness of parts of your life, and then you just begin to put into play the therapy or the treatment, and the good Lord does all the hard work. In our case, I just knew that I had to partner with all the different pregnancy centers in the region in order to fulfill the love of Jesus to my community, to allow us to become a vehicle for the power of the Holy Spirit. But that was literally just going to them and saying, hey, send your patients to us. We'll find a way to pay. The first few years, we were for profit. We try to pay it out of our profit margin. But then as, you know, medical issues became, you know, traumatic with malpractice premiums and, you know, government-run health care and the lack of religious freedom, we went not for profit because I couldn't go back on those three commands. I would be disobedient if I did that. And so I encourage everyone out there when they come visit, this is part of the secret of this place. It's be the best doc you can. Try to see the underserved in your daily work. And then lastly, follow the teachings of my son's church. And you can't go wrong, meaning it's a challenge, but you can't go wrong. There's peace and joy. And I can go to sleep at night knowing that I've served the Lord today. Because as you said, once you get filled with the Spirit, you got to share it with other people.
John, when you and I understand what we're talking about, Lee understands, I think our listeners understand the beauty of Tepeyac and of your work. We are entering into times now politically which are more and more fraught. There's less and less understanding of our point of view, of our holistic point of view that accepts the entire woman and her children as valuable and tender children of God. But what do you say when confronted with the idea that when a woman is pregnant with a child that she didn't plan or it's unexpected, that she and the child are somehow in opposition? Because I feel that is the general idea behind so many attacks. You know, the woman is in danger of her life being destroyed by the child in some way.
Yes, Grazi, you're absolutely on the point. One of the principles of Tepeyac here is you never pit mom against the baby. You never. Because I have to care for both patients. And just like faith and reason, they go together. Now, for the person who thinks abortion is health care, it's brutality and death to the child. And it's hurtful towards the woman, either in the short term or the long term. For instance, the rape patient, you know, the act of intimacy or the act of barbarism by the man on the woman is already there. The abortion just makes you going after, it kind of makes you go after the other innocent life here. Mm-hmm. That damage is already there internally. Right. And so what I have found is that you never pit mom against the baby. You try to get them both as far along as possible. And that's the key. And as long as you show people good science, whether it's the heartbeat, even the heartbeat now, people are getting so hardened. Oh, no, just tell me where to go to get the abortion. If you are able to show them women who have survived the experience they're going through, plus good science. So it's experiential, just like John Paul would talk about with his phenomenology, but it's also about good science. There's a heartbeat. There's a new life. You know, this, we can get through this together. There's a way to work through this so both can win. That's the key I have found over time. It's just meeting people where they're at, telling them that there is a kind of a healthier way to get through this challenge rather than ending the pregnancy, because that only ends the life. It doesn't end all the other issues that brought you to that point. In fact, it might exacerbate them.
Oh, I just wanted to ask you about the flip side of that with women who are experiencing secondary infertility, primary infertility, who wish to be pregnant, who are planning to get pregnant and can't. And you've got a program called Hannah's Hope. And can you tell us about this outreach?
Sure. Hannah's Hope is a conversation that we have with women struggling for fertility. Fertility is a desire. It's not a diagnosis. Infertility is not technically a diagnosis. It's a description. And so we try to bring together the best of medicine to show them real options of how we can help treat underlying causes through NAPRO technology, through surgery, how we can refer people in and out. But also, when none of that's working and you're beating yourself up again, you know, you're kind of beating yourself up, not you know, because either, you know, you think the infertility is not explainable, or maybe it's due to your own behavior, that the suffering, by leaning into the suffering through prayer, that suffering actually finds meaning. And that meaning can be some of the greatest growth experiences in anyone's life. But you don't come right out and say that. You kind of work with people and accompany them and walk with them. Hannah's hope for us, we're a MASH unit. The Mother of God said, Johnny, patch people up and send them back out to the front line. So your audience are truly the frontline heroes of today. The pro-life folks in front of the clinics, the people who pray that silent prayer every day for their family, the mom who doesn't throw out her daughter who either got pregnant or had an abortion, walking with them, accompanying them. My job is simply to just patch you up like a forward MASH unit and send you back out into the fight. And it's not easy at times, but the Holy Spirit is never outdone in generosity. And I have found that whether you are a evangelical or a Roman Catholic or a Orthodox or a Jew or a nothing, this approach resonates with people because there's an authenticity, there's an integration, and there's an attempt at listening. And it's like you said, conversations with consequences. Every patient we see, every history I take, every physical exam we do, every lab test we do, it's about conversations with consequences. And we literally know that it's a body, soul, and spirit integrated approach to health. End of discussion.
Dr. Brzezowski, you know, it's amazing to think of the fortune of your patients, the blessedness of your patients. So many doctors now think of themselves as vending machines, you know, just delivering whatever the patient wants, whether or not it's good for them. And you really see the whole person, and you see them as children of God. That's very apparent. And thank you so much for sharing your time with us. I know that your time is extremely valuable.
Oh, you are so kind, and thank you for everything. And we'll keep each other in our prayers.
Definitely, doctor.
Okay, thank you, doctor. See you in April.
And also,
oh my gosh, Lee, I can't wait.
It's always a good night.
And to our listeners, if you want to hear more, learn more about Dr. B's wonderful work, check out tepeyacobgyn.com. That's spelled TEPEYACOBGYN. And Divine Mercy Care at divinemercycare.org. And congrats again on your wonderful award, Dr. Brzezowski.
Oh, please. Thank you. God bless you.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences. I'm your hostess, Dr. Gracie Christie. We're so excited to have our good friend, Archbishop Joseph Naumann of Kansas City, who serves as the pro-life chair for the USCCB. Welcome to the show, Archbishop Naumann.
Thank you. It's good to be with you and your listeners.
Really, I'm very excited to have you on. You are, as I explained in the intro, you are the pro-life chair for the United States Council of Bishops. I'm so pro-life. It's such a huge part of my life, of the way I relate to everything, it seems, in my life, and I know many of our listeners are too. And I want to ask you if you could tell us, please, why is it such an important part of being Catholic?
Yes, well, thanks. We're grateful to hear your passion for this part of the church's teaching, and it's important. And I would summarize it with the reasons why the bishops 2 years ago said this is the preeminent public policy issue of our time and human rights issue of our time. The first reason is because it attacks life when it's most vulnerable, most defenseless. So that's the number one reason. The second reason is that it attacks the family and the bond, the most sacred bond between the mother and the child. And this culture of death pits mother's welfare against the child's life, which is, it's not true that their welfares are intertwined. Mm-hmm. But because it attacks that most fundamental of all human relationships, the foundation of the family, and that's the foundation of our church, our culture, our civilization. And then the third reason is just the sheer numbers. Over 61 million children killed by abortion since 1973. And with each one of those abortions, the second victim is the mother, because the court in 1973 put all of the responsibility on the woman. Mm-hmm. in a deceptively, they were saying, well, this is to empower women. But what they effectively did, they said, if the woman chooses abortion, the man has no responsibility in this at all. And so it's not only the lives of these innocent children, but it scars. And I've seen this through my experience with our post-abortion ministry, our Project Rachel ministry. It scars the mother and the father and many others that were implicated in it. And it scars them emotionally and spiritually. And sometimes, sadly, it scars the mother physically as well.
I think that legal abortion has had a terrible effect on our profession, our medical profession. It's cheapened our profession. It's twisted it. It's degraded our profession. It's said that there are times when a human person can be our patient and also our victim. So for me, abortion also is a terrible blight on the medical profession, which I think ought to be very noble and high-minded.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that we've rewritten the Hippocratic Oath and taken out what even, you know, pre-Christian culture saw as a true evil, and now we rewrite that. So fortunately, you know, with our Catholic Medical Association, with the students, the new doctors, we have a mass for them, and they take the original oath, and I'm so proud of them.
Yes, that's wonderful.
It has, right, it's, and now, you know, I think we're at a new moment where the proponents of abortion are no longer satisfied with it being an option or a choice, the rhetoric that they use for decades to get people to go along with it. But now they're trumpeting as healthcare and therefore as a right. And in doing that, now I think it's going to harm the medical profession more, because they're at a point where they're saying that institutions and doctors, nurses, they have to participate. Because, you know, as you know, most doctors and medical professionals don't want anything to do with abortion, but now they want to make everybody complicit and taxpayers complicit as well.
Yes. I've often thought that any time that a person has to be killed, it should be done by an executioner type and not involve the medical profession, whether that's an abortion or a suicide, an assisted suicide. I know that the medical profession is brought in as cover, as ethical cover and moral cover for what is a deeply unethical and immoral act.
No, do you, so you true.
Archbishop, you are the chair for the Pro-Life Committee, and this is a spectacularly important year for pro-lifers, for anyone who cares about the dignity of life, because this is the year that we are going to have a very important test case go before the Supreme Court. It's less than a couple months away that the Supreme Court is going to hear the arguments on December 1st. Are you helping to prepare the parishes to pray for this big moment or to understand the gravity of the situation?
Yes, absolutely. And we need everybody to be praying for this. I mean, this is a moment that those of us who've been in the pro-life movement for a long time that we've dreamed of and that we've hoped for so long. And we do have an initiative for Catholics and Christians joining across the country to pray for this. Your listeners can go to Pray for Dobbs, which is the name of the case, D-O-B-B-S, PrayForDobbs.com. That will access you to all sorts of information about how you can pray for wisdom for our Supreme Court justices and courage for them, because there's a lot of efforts to intimidate them at this time. And for the first time in almost 50 years, we have a court that we hope that there are a majority that if they don't overturn Roe v. Wade with this case, they will empower the states to have more ability to protect innocent human life.
Now, as someone who has been pro-life for a long time and has been closely watching all the situation and knows a lot about the Dobbs case and the Supreme Court makeup, do you have hope, apart from supernatural hope, that things will turn out okay?
Yes, I do have hope. I mean, I think when you look at the makeup of the court, it would seem, but we never know until they actually have to decide on a case. And so we have a lot of new members of the court since there's been any major case really taken up. There was the Texas case recently, but they really didn't decide on the substance of that. I think that was hopefully a positive sign that when they do rule on substance in the Dobbs case, that we'll get a good ruling. So I think there's legitimate reason to hope at this time. And there's been a lot of prayers and work and effort by many, many people to bring us to this point. I think one of the great goods that maybe the Lord's brought out of this terrible situation of legalized abortion is that the proponents thought if they kept abortion legal this long, that the opposition would have gone away. And yet, you know, I think the fact that this still becomes an important issue in every one of our elections, that it's still a question. And we see this with the March for Life every year, the passion, and even a new generation of young people that I think we could argue are more pro-life than my age, their grandparents' age, or even their parents' age.
Oh, yes, so, I agree.
You know, I think there are a lot of reasons to hope.
There's a couple reasons for that, it seems to me, is number one, the fact that a lot of these children have been hurt by abortion. These young people, I should say, have been hurt by abortion,
yes,
not necessarily directly, but they are living in that post-legal abortion world where so much damage has been done to the relationship between men and women, to the family, to marriage. They know there should be 60 or 70 million young people like them that don't exist because they've been destroyed. That's number one. But also number two is what I do for a living is fetal ultrasound, and those kinds of advances in science that have changed so much of our relationship to unborn human life, the way we understand it, the way we visualize it, and we are able to connect much more deeply now than we could in 1973 when Roe was passed.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, science is on our side.
Yes.
And the technology is on our side as well. And so you're exactly right. You know, I think the ultrasound imaging has made the humanity of the unborn undeniable. And it's been a great help, you know, as you know, with our crisis pregnancy centers. And thank goodness for the Knights of Columbus that will donate these ultrasound machines to crisis pregnancy centers and give parents an opportunity to see their child. And that's been powerful in saving many, many lives.
Yes, I work for pregnancy centers and I read their ultrasounds. And another thing that it does is it brings the women in the first place because they want to date their pregnancies, and it keeps them out of the clutches of places like Planned Parenthood, where they'll give you a dating ultrasound, but then they shuttle you right into the abortionist's clinic right next door. They'll give you the ultrasound and they'll say, okay, great, we can do an abortion because the baby's only 11 weeks. It really does. The Knights of Columbus have been fabulous with that help. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Conversations with Consequences. I'm your hostess, Dr. Gracie Christie, and we're chatting with Archbishop Joseph Nauman of Kansas City, Kansas, and he's also the pro-life chair for the USCCB. Your Excellency, I wanted to ask you about St. Joseph, the year of St. Joseph, and I wanted to read back to you something you wrote recently. As the faithful protector of both Jesus and Mary, we find in St. Joseph a profound reminder of our own call to welcome, safeguard, and defend God's precious gift of human life. What connections do you think we ought to be making between St. Joseph and his example for us and our pro-life commitments?
Pope Francis has given us this year of St. Joseph, and one of the descriptors that he gave of Joseph in the letter introducing this year was he talked about St. Joseph having creative courage. And I love that. I love that term. And I think that's what we need at this moment as well. I've always been blessed to have St. Joseph as a patron. And part of the reason my mother named me, my father was killed when my mother was pregnant with me.
Oh, no.
And so my mother felt, well, St. Joseph was a really good foster father for Jesus, so she thought that was pretty good credentials for making him my foster father. So I've always had a great devotion to him, but I think, you know, Joseph shows, you know, true manliness, true fatherhood, you know, in that he's a protector of Mary and Jesus. And, you know, his life is constantly being interrupted. I think he must have been afraid to go to sleep at night at one point because he was getting these dreams with messages from the Lord. And they would interrupt his life. But, I mean, he says nothing in the scripture, but we see his actions. He moves quickly and decisively to protect Mary, to protect Jesus. And that's what we need all of us to do today. And I think there's a special message for men that we need to exercise this true paternity to be protectors of mothers and children both.
Oh, you're so right, Your Excellency. It's such a beautiful example. And you know, these days, manhood is barely considered a virtue. And St. Joseph is a person who exhibits that shining, beautiful, noble manhood that can sacrifice itself and can live for the other completely. What a beautiful example in these days where manhood is not... It's considered toxic if it's talked about at all.
Yes, and you know, I think so many of our men are confused by the culture today, and we need these great examples of being true men, authentic men, and what it means to be true fathers. And as I said, you know, the abortion decision, one of the things it did was it stripped the father of any ability to protect his child. And it actually incentivized fathers to encourage the mothers to abort the child because then they had no responsibility. That's a real tragedy. It's wounded mothers, but it's also wounded the fathers as well.
Yes, and it's a terrible tragedy when one thinks to know, I haven't known someone like this personally, but imagine that feeling of knowing that your child is going to be destroyed and not being able to defend the child because the law has stripped you of that right and the culture has stripped you of that right. You're basically told right from the beginning that your opinion doesn't matter. You're only the father, as though something more important than fatherhood exists.
Yes, exactly. And I have known through our post-abortion ministry men that suffer from this a great deal, that their impotence because of the law to be able to protect their children and to really love the mother of their child as well. We know after abortion, so many of those relationships are destroyed as well.
You know, what it has done, I'm sure you agree, is that since it's all in the woman's lap, she gets to decide. Then if she does bring the baby to life, it ceases to be the man's responsibility because she could have aborted. I'm talking about irresponsible men here.
Yeah, you're right. It's been destructive, as I said, of the family, of the whole family, you know, and this is obviously not God's plan, what he created is for. And we know, and there's so much data that shows how important the father is in the development of the child. And we're living with so many wounds today in a culture where there's so many children growing up without their father in the home. I grew up in a single parent family, but it was the circumstances were different than many today, where the father has either chosen or they both chosen to not have this cohesive family that is the optimal environment for a child to grow.
So you had the difficulties of a household headed by your poor mother, who had to be everything to you and to your siblings, but you didn't have that sense of abandonment, perhaps.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I was blessed. I had a lot of good examples, good male examples in my life and family, and also the priests of our parish were very influential in my life. And I think, you know, part of the Lord can bring good out of tragedy. And I wonder today if I would have been a priest if the circumstances were different. But it was one of the reasons I think I was attracted to the priesthood, because I saw how important the priests were for our family.
Oh, that's lovely. It's so true. It's for many young people, it's only the priest of the parish is the person who gives them that fatherhood that they need so badly.
Yeah.
In my life, Your Excellency, I became very pro-life when my husband and I adopted our fifth child. And yeah, I realized that this little girl who had been abandoned on the street was that quintessential unwanted person. And it taught me in a way that excited me so much that I became very intense about it, that there are no unwanted people and that God creates everyone out of love and with a deep purpose. There's no purposeless creation. Do you think that's something that people need to spend more time praying about how every soul is made with a purpose?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I think Mother Teresa used to speak about the greatest poverty is the poverty that says we can't love one more child, we can't clothe one more child or house one more child, and that each life is a miracle and has a purpose in God's plan, that and when we fulfill that purpose, the world is better. We draw love. Children draw love out of their parents and out of their families when they're embraced and accepted. That's why our crisis pregnancy centers are so important, to surround mothers that are experiencing a difficult pregnancy with support and with a loving community. And another issue that, you know, I think is very important in our time and for the church to be involved with is the need for foster care parents as well. I know in Kansas here, that's a high priority for us, that so many of our children are languishing in, oftentimes in the foster care system, and we need to raise up adoptive parents and foster care parents in from our Catholic communities, and our parishes need to surround those families with love and support.
Well, thank you, Excellency, for bringing that up. It's a very important thing, and some of us might be called to foster or to support people who foster, and we should all prayerfully think about that. So thank you so much for making time for us today. It's a great honor to have you on, and we will go to PrayForDobbs.com so we can remember to pray for the wonderful cause of maybe Roe v. Wade not being the law of the land in sometime soon. So thank you, Your Excellency.
Thanks, Dr. Christie, and thanks. It's been a pleasure to be part of a conversation of consequence with you. Thanks for great ministry you do on the radio.
Oh, thank you. Our honor, truly. And now, Father Roger Landry offers us, as is customary, a short and inspiring homily to prepare us for this Sunday's Gospel.
This is Father Roger Landry, and it's a privilege for me to be with you as we enter into the consequential conversation the risen Lord Jesus wants to have with each of us this Sunday, in which he will give us orientations he would like us to have as we begin this Advent season and new liturgical year. Advent is about preparing for Christ's second coming by reliving the preparation of the Jewish people for his first coming, by embracing him in the present, in the various ways he comes to us, most especially in prayer and the sacraments. Jesus begins this Sunday's passage by talking about the end times, which he says will feature changes in the sun, moon, and stars, the shaking of the heavens, and the roaring of the seas and the waves. He was describing how the things by which people would normally at his time get their bearings, like the sun during the day and the moon and stars at night, would be dramatically altered, and people would be like mariners on convulsing seas. Things in which people formerly took their security would be no more. At that time, he says, we will see the Son of Man, Jesus our incarnate Lord, coming in a cloud with power and great glory. We celebrated last week the solemnity of Christ the King, and this is a divine image taken from the book of the prophet Daniel. He was saying we would find our bearings in him, in his divinity, shining through our humanity. And to this coming of our Redeemer, we should respond in four ways. First, he says, we should stand erect and raise our heads because our redemption is at hand. Shouldn't try to hide, we shouldn't run away, should lift up our heads, our hearts, our whole existence with anticipation and joy to our Redeemer. It's common for us to be weighed down by the things of the world, like the woman in St. Luke's Gospel for 18 years was bent over and incapable of standing up straight, whom Jesus healed on the Sabbath in a synagogue. We often don't take our eyes off the ground. We focus on our worries. We obsess about what weighs us down. As we begin this new liturgical year, Jesus tells us to get up and raise our minds to him, our hearts to him, our souls to him, with all our strength. Our redemption is at hand, and he wants us to seize it. He comes precisely to redeem us, and that should make us eager, not alarmed. Second, he tells us to be vigilant. Elsewhere in the Gospel, Jesus gave a parable about a second coming in which he contrasted the faithful and prudent steward who awaited his master's return and faithfully fed himself and others with the nourishment the master provided, versus the unfaithful and stupid servant who said, my master is long delayed, and began to get smashed and to abuse the servants under his care. We remember that when Jesus came into the world the first time, some people were vigilant, prayerful, and ready, but most were not. Mary Immaculate was ready and said a hearty yes to God's will. St. Joseph was ready and therefore capable of adapting quickly to God's mysterious plan. The shepherds were ready, vigilant at night, and ran to Bethlehem as soon as they heard the good news of great joy. The Magi were ready, so ready, in fact, that they were ready to discern the newborn king's presence through the presence of a star. On the other hand, Herod was not ready, too caught up in his own pride and sensuality and his own fears and anxieties to recognize that the source of his authority had come. The innkeepers weren't ready, too ensconced in their business and in their need for order, that they didn't have room to house their creator. The scholars of the law were not ready, to make even the short 6-mile journey downhill from Jerusalem to Bethlehem to discover and learn from the divine legislator. The vast majority of the Jewish people, who had been awaiting the advent of their Messiah for centuries, were simply and sadly not prepared when at last he came. Jesus does not want us to be caught off guard like them. He wants us to learn from their mistakes. He wants us to be alert for every way he comes to us, so that we might recognize his presence, be faithfully freed by him from whatever enshackles us, to faithfully feed ourselves and others with the gifts he provides. He wants this new church year we begin on Sunday to be the best spiritual year of our life. Third, he tells us to pray, specifically to pray that we have the strength to escape the imminent tribulation and to stand before him. It's quite realistic about temptations and our need for strength in the face of them. We remember what happened in the Garden of Gethsemane when Jesus took Peter, James, and John apart from the others to pray with him. He instructed them, "Watch and pray that you may not undergo the test, for the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." Their weak flesh, however, won out. They didn't stay awake and pray, but fell asleep. When the soldiers came for Jesus, they all underwent and failed the test. To remain strong under trial, we must remain with God, and we remain with God in prayer. Prayer wakes us up to see that God is alive and is with us. It helps us to escape caving into tribulation, but to convert a tribulation into an opportunity to give witness and to glorify God. Fourth, Jesus tells us to make sure that our hearts do not become drowsy from carousing and drunkenness and the anxieties of daily life. This is the opposite of standing erect and raising our heads, the contrary to vigilance and prayer. The way Jesus does not want us to live is to let our hearts fall asleep by seeking worldly pleasures, or being eaten alive by worries, or by anesthetizing our existence through drunkenness or other addictive escapes. The possession of pleasure and pain and the escape all keep us from concentrating on Jesus. We can't lift up our heads and our hearts to the Lord if our heads and hearts are asleep. So as we begin this new liturgical year, it's a time for us to make some resolutions based on Jesus' imperatives. The great English 20th century scribe G.K. Chesterton once said, "The object of a new year is not that we should have a new year. It is that we should have a new soul and a new nose, new feet, a new backbone, new ears, new eyes. Unless a particular man made New Year's resolutions, he would make no resolutions. If we don't make resolutions now, we may never make them," is his point. And so at the beginning of this new liturgical year, it's a time for us to make a concrete resolution to pray more and better each day. It's an occasion to consider coming to daily Mass, seeking to meet with eagerness the same Jesus in the Eucharist we hope to meet when he comes in the clouds. It's an opportunity for us to make straight the paths of the Lord through not just a good confession, but the best confession of our life. It's another chance for us to become good Samaritans, to care for those in need, to sacrifice lovingly for our neighbor in imitation of the way Jesus lovingly sacrificed for us. It's the moment to stand erect, raise our heads, defibrillate our hearts, stay alert, and enter into communion with him. One means by which Catholics in various places throughout the centuries have sought to turn Advent into devotion is through the Advent wreath, which we will bless in our churches and many of us will use in our homes. The most important part of the Advent wreath, we know, is not the color of the candles, which symbolize the hopeful spirit of the weeks, or the evergreens, which symbolize God's eternal love. The most important part is the flame, which symbolizes our prayerful vigilance for Christ's coming. Just like the 5 wise bridesmaids in Jesus' parable, whose lamps were always burning in anticipation for the return of the bridegroom. So the flame of these candles symbolize and reminds us of the flame of desire we're called to have for Jesus' return. The Advent wreath is meant to help us to remain always ready for Christ's light to irradiate our entire life. It's a sign of vigilance, of not falling asleep, of not letting our faith in his love and our longing for him peter out. It's an external sign of how, week by week, not just throughout Advent, but throughout our year in life, our flame of love for God is supposed to be growing, until our entire existence is a living flame of love, burning in Advent for Christ. Advent is ultimately a gift of the Lord to bring us back to what's most important in life, God's love for us and our response to Him in faith and love. And on this first day of this new liturgical year, let us ask the Lord for the grace to make this a truly holy year, a year of prayer, a year of faith, a year of increased love, a true year of the Lord. O come, Emmanuel. God bless you.
Thank you, Father Landry. To hear more from Father Landry, check out his website at catholicpreaching.com, and you can also catch his writings at EWTN's own National Catholic Register. A big thank you to all our listeners for joining us. I hope that this show was helpful. I hope that it gave you more peace and more hope and more joy, and you go with our prayers.